This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Take Back the Land is a radical movement in the United States that demands housing for the homeless. We'll hear about projects in the United States as well as in South Africa.
This is a movement that has no respect for private property. They say housing is a human right and they're going to take it over.
We'll learn about a recent lawsuit filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights against communication management units.
These are two units in supermax prisons in Illinois and Indiana where people can be locked up, prevented from even hugging their loved ones, and their communications restricted mostly on the basis of their religion, mostly Muslim, or their political outspokenness.
We'll also hear segments from an event titled FBI Entrapment, Personal Stories of Preemptive Prosecution.
We hear the voices of families whose loved ones have been entrapped by the FBI.
Stay with us. Michael, we've talked a lot on Law and Disorder about the security state, fingerprinting, eye scans, a national ID program. And we just learned that in Great Britain, secondary schools, about 80 of them, have introduced a new method of scanning the thumbs of their students. It's part of a system to replace ID swipe cards for things like borrowing library books, paying for meals instead of using cash. And apparently the parents are up in arms about this because the plan was introduced without consulting them and apparently doesn't need parental approval.
So now they're going to have a bio database on children in England. And I suppose that that practice is aimed right here at the United States. And there are probably people in the United States thinking of picking up on that as well.
I'm sure. Now, let me just say that authorities there say that the thumb scan is converted into a 4-digit PIN code, and they claim cannot be converted into a fingerprint. I don't trust it.
Neither do I.
Well, in another different kind of tracking the whereabouts of individuals, it's come out recently that the FBI has been contacting Americans who have recently traveled to Cuba through cultural exchange programs such as the Venceremos Brigade. We know plenty of people who've gone down on that. They send about 100 people to Cuba each year. Now, we know that travelers have been visited or getting a stern letter, rather, in the past from the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control. They tell them about the penalties, and the Center for Constitutional Rights and the National Lawyers Guild for years have represented individuals who've gotten those letters. But this involvement by the FBI is new.
Yeah, it's curious. You know, the law is that you can go to Cuba. They can't stop you from traveling, but you can't spend money there, and that's why it comes under the Treasury Department. The FBI is totally out of its jurisdiction here. I suppose the link is that they've still got Cuba, if you can believe it, on a list of terrorist countries. And maybe that's why they're questioning people who come back.
Yes. And good to know that Michael Ratner and the Center for Constitutional Rights are planning to file a Freedom of Information Act request with the Justice Department to, in fact, try to find out more about the rationale for the Bureau's interest in these recent visits.
Absolutely. And now for the latest Pope news. The Pope, who Richard Dawkins, the world's most famous atheist, calls an evil, leering old man in a frock, is in the line of fire for covering up of the child molestation by a priest named Father Murphy in my old hometown in Milwaukee, covering up that this priest molested 200 or more deaf children. The attorneys handling the case for some of these children have gotten letters showing that the Pope was copied on these complaints. That, in fact, the Pope, Benedict, before he left Germany, where he's also in trouble for covering up complaints of child rape by priests in Germany, then went on to the Vatican. there, he headed up for 30 years the office of the Inquisition. They've changed the name, but the bureau that he headed up is the Inquisition. That goes all the way back to the 15th century. You'll remember Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, who sent Columbus to America in 1492. Well, they also launched the Inquisition. They forced all Jews to either convert or be killed. They drove the Muslims out of southern Spain. This was the Inquisition. Cardinal Ratzinger, who's now Pope Benedict, was the head of the Inquisition for 30 years. One of the duties of that body was to supervise these complaints of the priests raping children. And the Pope is now directly implicated in covering this up and not investigating it and turning a blind eye towards it. It's interesting because during that time, Cardinal Ratzinger, being in charge of the Inquisition, did a purge of the what was called liberation theology priests in Central and Latin America. The most famous was Leonardo Boffo from Brazil. These priests thought that the true gospel of Christ was to look out for poor people, that was Jesus' mission, and that should be the mission of the church now. But evidently, Cardinal Ratzinger thought that the true mission of the hierarchy of the church was to look out for each other.
Well, let me just say, in the Pope's defense, which there isn't really much to defend, probably the rationale for doing this was to avoid scandal in the church, as always, to protect the image of the Catholic Church and to hide its dirty little secrets.
That's precisely what it was. But that raises the question of whose church is it? Is it the church of the people who attend and look to it for succor and help and guidance? Or is the church of the all-male celibate hierarchy?
Well, I think you've just answered that question. I believe, Michael, the cardinal's defense was that although he knew about this, he really wasn't the person who could do anything about it. Someone else was in charge.
Yeah, well, I think that that's a weak defense. He was in charge, ultimately. He knew about it. When a complaint came from Bishop Weakland, who was the bishop in Milwaukee, because there were pickets outside of the cathedral, you know. And when the complaint came in, Cardinal Ratzinger did nothing about it for 8 months and finally transferred the priest from Milwaukee up to northern Wisconsin, where he was still allowed to conduct his affairs. And he, when the priest died, he was buried with full honors as a priest. He was never defrocked. He was never prosecuted. The prosecutor in Milwaukee refused to do anything about it. These victims were just crazed because they went everywhere and
for
no
help.
One would help them.
No one would
no
listen.
One would help them. And now the scandal's coming out from Germany to Ireland to the United States and right up to the Vatican. So it's going to be interesting to see how this one spins out.
Well, Michael, there's never been anything such as eviction of a pope or defrocking, has there?
It's institutionally impossible because he's the highest person in the hierarchy, and whatever he does is supposed to be infallible. So by definition, he's there for good. But I think that only tends to accelerate the discrediting of what is a reactionary institution. The various local groups affiliated with the American Take Back the Land movement are launching actions in May, direct actions to put homeless people back into property they've been evicted from, or back into empty lots where they can use them for public use, or back into empty homes. Today we are joined by Center for Constitutional Rights staff attorney Sunita Patel, who's going to be part of the legal team supporting these national Take Back the Land movements. Sunita has recently traveled to Cape Town and Durban, South Africa, where she met with comrades in South Africa also involved in their own Take Back the Land movement.
Sunita Patel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We've just been reading up and learning about the so-called Take Back the Land movement. We understand that the Center for Constitutional Rights is involved. Can you give us a bit of background?
We have been speaking to and discussing with Take Back the Land, which started in Miami with someone called Max Rameau and a few other folks there. And they have really done some spectacular work, really radical and cutting-edge work on taking back the land that originally belongs to people and poor people, and trying to think about redistribution of wealth and redistribution of land, especially in the housing crisis that we're in. the Center for Constitutional Rights with Take Back the Land went on a delegation to South Africa during the first week of March. And we decided to go after hearing from two of the extraordinary community organizers and leaders from the Abekhlale Basimjolo movement, which I'll just say ABM for short, the movement that is in South Africa. And they came to the Center for Constitutional Rights and said, you know, we need help. We need people to hear our struggle. We need people to know what is happening in South Africa and how the South African government is not doing what it has committed to.
Because they have a huge homelessness problem there.
I think that they don't consider it homelessness in the same way that we do. The history in South Africa around apartheid is so connected to land and redistribution of land from moving different groups of people to different parts of the cities and moving people out of the cities. So one of the, and I can come back to this a little bit in terms of the history if you want, but so we decided to send a delegation and really hear from people firsthand. So we started off in Cape Town meeting with organizers and community members from an organization called the Western Cape Anti-Eviction Campaign. And this was really through a contact and a connection that Max had. So we spent a few days there. While we were there, we also met with a women-led trade union of farm workers called Sekule Sonke, which stands for We Grow Together. And they're also organizing around land issues, but more around farm and rural area in the rural areas. We then traveled to the other side of the country, to Durban and KwaZulu-Natal, and visited with ABM and another organization called the Rural Land Network. And throughout the trip, we observed that activists and community members were really struggling for justice. And they were sharing with us stories, terrible stories of mass displacements and evictions at the government's hands and without any redress. They felt without any redress. But we also heard these amazing, courageous, and inspiring common stories of resistance against the state.
Taking those lessons back here with the Take Back the Land movement in Florida, where Max is, or even here in New York City with Picture of the Homeless, I understand there's going to be a big campaign starting in May with the notion that the Troubled Asset Relief Program took our money and bailed out the banks to the tune of $1.5 trillion, which is hard to even imagine how much money that is, and really bought back these homes that had gone under. And now these homes are vacant. In the meantime, there are all these people who are homeless. And the Take Back the Land movement seeks to take people and put them back in these vacant homes, which is really quite extraordinary because, you can't touch that. That's private property. And the Take Back the Land people are saying, aren't they, Sunita, we don't care if it's private property. It's the right and moral thing to do, and we're moving back.
That's right. I mean, I think that we have a lot to learn from the movement in South Africa on these issues. The principled and ethical idea of land ownership is one that in the United States, because of the entrenchment, the real entrenchment of capitalism, we can't even think beyond private ownership of land. In South Africa, we really heard a debate amongst community members, lawyers, advocates, even government officials around community ownership of land and communal rights to land. Although the government may not recognize that and the courts haven't exactly upheld those concepts, there is that discussion there. Here in the United States, we're so far from that. And that is one of the reasons why the very honorable and inspiring work of poor people that are connected to Take Back the Land is really something that the Center for Constitutional Rights wants to support, and we really want to stand with those activists.
A lot of the work sounds to me a bit like squatting. Is that part of the modus operandi?
And are you mean in terms of in the United States?
In the United States.
The land work?
Yeah.
Well, I think that there could be a concept of squatting and the squatters movement around taking ownership of property and vacant homes. And I think that there is that thread there. And obviously, for decades, people have been taking over vacant and foreclosed, perhaps not foreclosed, but vacant land and homes in particular. And here you see a real movement that is people-centered and led by people who are actually affected by the homelessness situation in the United States that are saying, you know what, there is a foreclosed home across the street, and it's really just unethical that there are homeless people across the street from that and who are willing to take the huge risk of saying this home, this property belongs to the people and we need to move people in. And I think that this is really going to potentially challenge the banking structure and the land ownership relationship that as we know it.
We're speaking with Sunita Patel, who's a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights and one of the attorneys at the center who's working with the people in the Take Back the Land movement. Sunita, I'm sure you would agree housing is a human right. That's
right.
A principle of ours and a principle of Take Back the Land movement. But how do we enforce that in terms of the law? Where is it said in any laws in the United States or international laws that housing is a human right?
Well, unfortunately, housing is not a constitutionally protected right. I think that where we are able to gain from international human rights law, we need to start trying to infuse that into our work in the United States. So the Universal Declaration of Human Rights recognizes housing as a human right, or recognizes that shelter and housing should be afforded to everyone. There's also several social and economic rights, covenants, and protocols, which unfortunately the United States is not a signatory to or hasn't and haven't ratified some of those very important provisions. So this is one step that communities can think about, you know, asking your officials, what is your position on social and economic rights as a human rights principle? And just to come back to South Africa for a moment, one of the really amazing things is that the Constitution is very radical in that way. It's very progressive. It does borrow from a lot of these international human rights treaties and documents that embody these principles. However, when we talked to the people on the ground, they said, this is just a piece of paper. We don't have a way of making sure that everyone has a home. Even though the Constitution states in Article 26 and 33, they've been read by the courts in South Africa to provide for one home per one family, there really just isn't that the meaningful way of achieving that because at the same time, the government is also upholding the rights of white landowners and their historic colonial and other methods of taking land from poor people and mostly black people in South Africa.
Well, here in the United States, I understand that May of this year is the month of action for the Take Back the Land movement. What sort of things are you contemplating?
They are really looking at a variety of locally led actions. And at the Center for Constitutional Rights, what we're doing is just providing some backup support on what may happen as a result of some of those actions. And, you know, we're really here to try to provide the support that the organizations ask for. You know, one thing that was really interesting in South Africa is to really think about, and one of the things we went there to learn about was the relationship of lawyers and movements in South Africa. And there, you know, here in the United States, lawyers and policy organizations often, you know, set the agenda for social justice issues. And really, this idea needs to be challenged. So we have to, as progressives and radicals, be really mindful of where we take directions from and how we come up with the justice issues that we're working on. And I think it's in particular as litigators, it's really just not easy to do. But it's something that in South Africa, we kept hearing from people that to really understand the movements and the struggles of poor people, that we really need to be standing with them and not for them.
That's right. And legendary people's lawyer Arthur Conoy was a huge proponent that we listen to the people, we work with them, we don't tell them what to do. I think that's what all of us who consider ourselves people's lawyers know.
There's certainly a whole number of things we can do out there. There are people who are being evicted, and those evictions can be stopped. There are empty homes that people could be put back into. There are empty government buildings that people could be put into. There's empty lots that could be used for public purposes. This shifts the whole paradigm. If you think, well, people have rights. Private property is not sacred. We're in the middle of a crisis in this country that we haven't seen since the 30s. And I think that the Take Back the Land movement is a real breath of fresh air, Sunita. It's a joy to see the lawyer part of the movement gearing up to work with the people on these issues.
Sunita, if people are interested in learning more about this movement or about Take Back the Land, where can they go for information?
They should look at the Take Back the Land website at takebacktheland.org. Max Rameau has also published a book from, I think it's 2008, and it's called Land Gentrification and the Umoja Village Shantytown. And it tells the story of Take Back the Land Miami and their efforts to create, and their six-month occupation, really, of an entire plot of land where they were able to provide housing and really question and challenge these very fundamental issues.
That's Max Rameau, R-A-M-E-A-U, and it's called Take Back the Land.
Sunita Patel, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder.
Thanks, Sunita.
Thank you.
Last week, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit challenging violations of fundamental rights, including that of due process, at two experimental federal prison units called Communications Management Units. The units are being used overwhelmingly to hold Muslim inmates and those with unpopular political beliefs who have been in the habit of speaking out. The units have been described as an experiment in social isolation. In addition to heavily restricted phone and visitation access, CMU inmates are categorically denied any physical contact with family members and are forbidden from hugging, touching, or embracing their children or spouses during visits. Attorneys say this blanket ban on contact visitation, which is unique in the federal prison system, not only causes suffering to the families of the incarcerated men, but is a violation of fundamental constitutional rights. Joining us today to talk about the lawsuit is Rachel Maripol, attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Rachel Maripol, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We understand that the Center for Constitutional Rights has just filed a lawsuit on what are called CMUs, or Communication Management Units.
That's correct. We've just filed a lawsuit in the district court in D.C. on behalf of current and former prisoners at the unit and some of their family members.
This is an experimental facility.
It's true. It's the first time we've seen units like this in the federal system. Now, the Bureau of Prisons sort of secretly created these units in 2006 and 2007 under the Bush administration. Normally, when the Bureau of Prisons creates sort of a new type of unit or a new rule that affects the lives of prisoners, they have to do that through notice and comment rulemaking, which basically just means that the public has an opportunity to look at the proposed rule and make comments what they think about it. The Bureau of Prisons actually did invite public comment on a unit very much like this in 2006, and there were so many comments from individuals talking about what a bad idea it was and all of the constitutional violations that the Bureau of Prisons withdrew the rule and then simply did it in secret.
I understand there are two units. One is in Indiana and the other in Illinois.
One's in Terre Haute, Indiana, and the other is Marion, Illinois.
The name, actually, Communications Management Unit, suggests that one of the reasons inmates may be transferred there are to prevent them from speaking out on social justice issues.
Well, I think that's exactly what we're seeing. Now, there's really no meaningful process at all as to who should be put in this unit. The Bureau of Prisons has published very broad criteria about the type of individuals it thinks belongs there. The criteria is so broad that it could encompass, you know, tens of thousands of prisoners. But when we look at who is actually being sent to the unit, it's mostly Muslim, Middle Eastern Muslims, as well as African American individuals who've converted to Islam in prison. And then it's also a lot of people with unpopular political views. So one of our clients, Daniel McGowan, is an environmental activist who's serving a term in prison. Now, he never violated a prison rule. He was in a low-security prison for the first couple years of his sentence, never violated a prison rule, was never disciplined for anything relating to communications, and then, without explanation, is moved into this highly restrictive unit.
Attorney Rachel Maripol from the CCR, what's life like for somebody who gets put in a CMU unit?
Well, it's really an experiment in social isolation. The most important fact, I think, for our clients is that they have absolutely no opportunity for physical contact with their loved ones or friends. So when they receive a visit, you know, they have very few opportunities for visits, much less than most people in the federal system. And when they do get a visit, it's only through plexiglass. Now, a blanket ban on contact visitation is absolutely unique within the federal system. Even ADX, the most maximum security prison in the federal system, doesn't have that kind of blanket ban. Now, this is just uniquely cruel for the individuals that have to undergo it. Some of our clients have young children who they can't really communicate with in any meaningful way over the phone or by letter. And physical contact, you know, being able to hug your two-year-old, hold your four-year-old, that's really the only way that they would have the opportunity to maintain those essential family relationships. Now, of course, we know that not only is it difficult and cruel for the prisoners, but for their children and loved ones as well. And moreover, it's simply bad public policy. You know, these individuals are going to be released from prison at some point. If they're released without having maintained their family ties, all the studies show uniformly that they're much more likely to end up reoffending or having other troubles with reentering free society.
Well, what about their phone calls, their letter writing, their contact with other inmates, their ability to exercise in the yard? You know, how is it different from being in a normal prison?
Well, all of their mail and phone calls are monitored 100%. Now, that's different from most federal prisons. However, that's not really what we're complaining about in the lawsuit. Rather, what we are seeking to challenge is the extreme limitations on their access to phone calls and visits. So most prisoners in the federal system get 300 minutes of telephone calls, 300 minutes on the telephone a month. My clients, however, for years only had one 15-minute call a week and only recently have been given a second 15-minute call a week. This call has to be scheduled a week ahead of time. So if they try to make the call and it doesn't go through, the person's not available, something goes wrong, they don't get another opportunity to call somebody else. For prisoners with large families, this is just, you know, incredibly difficult. We have one client in the case who has five children. So for each 15-minute call, he gets to speak to his five children and his wife, you know, for less than 2 minutes each.
Rachel, considering that Daniel McGowan is in there, I understand, and we've covered his case on the show, Daniel was convicted on terrorism-related charges, specifically arson in environmental cases. Is it because his case was called a terrorism-related case that you think he might be transferred there?
Well, it's really not clear. And I mean, this is one of the problems. The Bureau of Prisons simply isn't putting forward actual information about why people are being transferred. Now, we do think that in Daniel's case, part of the reason might have been based on the fact that he had a terrorism enhancement attached to his sentence. However, I don't think that's the actual real story. I think that, you know, Daniel continued to be outspoken when he was in, even after he was imprisoned. He spoke out about, through on a blog, about social justice issues, about supporting political prisoners. And I think that really his move to the CMU is about controlling that kind of activism. Now, the reason we think that is that we have a lot of other people who sort of fit that same profile. You know, several of our clients are African-American Muslims who spent 10 to 15 years in various federal facilities without significant disciplinary histories, yet had sort of a leadership role in the Muslim community at their prior facilities, or were jailhouse lawyers, you know, people who were advocating for themselves and for other prisoners about rights violations that they saw in prison. Now, these individuals, too, are being transferred into the CMU. So it seems to me that this is truly about silencing advocacy from inside prison.
Can you explain a bit about Yasin Aref's case?
Sure. So some of our clients, including Mr. Aref, were convicted of terrorism-related charges, in his case, material support. We're seeing a lot of individuals like that being transferred to the CMU immediately or shortly after sentencing. Now, it seems as though their transfer is related simply to their conviction, nothing else. Now, because of that, they expect to have to spend, you know, perhaps their entire sentence in these units. These are folks who are looking at, you know, 15 to 20-year sentences without physical contact with their loved ones. Mr. Aref has young children who he hasn't been able to touch in years and may not be able to touch until they're practically grown adults.
This is a kind of sensory deprivation that almost amounts to torture.
Well, I do think that the ability to have some physical contact with one's loved one is sort of a basic human need, deprivation of which is cruel and unusual punishment, can be an incredibly torturous experience. Now, the prisoners aren't completely isolated from any physical contact. They, you know, run into each other on the basketball court. They're not sort of isolated in their cells. They can walk around the unit. So the unit is segregated from the general prison, from the rest of the prison. But within the unit, they actually have some degree of freedom to talk with other prisoners who they're in the unit with, to watch television, to go out onto the yard, take recreation. So it's really about isolating these prisoners from the outside world and the rest of the prison population, but not necessarily from each other.
Rachel Mirapol, you're handling this case for the Center for Constitutional Rights against these communication management units. To sum up, could you just tell us in a nutshell what's at stake here?
Sure. Well, any time that the Bureau of Prisons operates with absolutely no process and claims the ability to move prisoners into extremely restrictive confinement without explanation or opportunity for meaningful review, those of us who have been involved in this work for a while recognize that, of course, that's going to lead to individuals being treated harshly for discriminatory or retaliatory reasons. Now, those who have done work supporting political prisoners in the past must know that this history has been going on for decades, and the CMUs are just the latest incarnation.
Rachel, when was this suit filed, and what's the next step?
The suit was filed last week in D.C. District Court, and so now the Bureau of Prisons and the individual defendants who we've sued, including the Attorney General and the Director of the Bureau of Prisons, will have some time to either answer the lawsuit or to seek a dismissal from a judge if that's what they'd like to do.
Rachel, this was really great to have you on so soon after the filing, and we look forward to hearing updates as this proceeds through the windy halls of justice.
Absolutely. I always love to be on the show.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks a lot, Rachel.
Thank you, guys.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Smith from the Dustbusters, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
We go now to hear segments from the event titled FBI Entrapment, Personal Stories of Preemptive Prosecution, sponsored by the National Lawyers Guild, Middle Eastern Law Students Association, Islamic Law Students Association, and Law Students for Human Rights. Families and community members gathered in a room at NYU to discuss their cases and how their family members were entrapped by FBI informants and agent provocateur tactics. As we've reported in the past few years, the FBI have used these tactics to target Muslims and others by offering money and assets within impoverished communities. Some FBI groups target mosques and actually incite violent action. Most informants are felons that have made plea deals with the FBI. As we've seen, these stories often make headlines on especially patriotic holidays around the country, such as Memorial Day or the 4th of July. Meanwhile, the men implicated in the FBI stings continue to serve long prison sentences. We now get an inside perspective from their families. We hear from Lynn Jackson and attorney Stephen Downs, founders of Project Salaam.
Good evening. My name is Lynn Jackson. I'm from Albany, New York. This is Steve Downs and Kathy Manley, their attorneys. We're with Project Salaam. Project Salaam stands for support and legal advocacy for Muslims. I'm going to talk a little bit about the case in Albany. The case in Albany involves Imam Yassin Aref and pizza shop owner Muhammad Hussein. They were entrapped by the FBI. What happened is that Muhammad Hussein owned a pizza shop in downtown Albany. A man, oh, wait a second. That's the same man that went to the Newburgh Four, but he had a different name in Albany, but the same man. And we called him Malik. And Malik would come to the pizza shop and say to the pizza shop owner's lovely wife, Fatima, please, I want to talk to your husband. After coming many times, finally, her husband, Muhammad, met with him. And basically, Malik, over many, many months, said, oh, I'd like to loan you money. Oh, let me loan you money. You're such a good brother. Teach me about Islam. I'll loan you money. Oh, and you can keep some of the money, etc., etc. So finally, what happened is that Muhammad Hussein accepted the loan and began to pay it back, but they needed a witness. The witness that they used was Imam Yassin Aref, because, of course, that is what imams do, is to witness loans between Muslims. The upshot of all this is that both men, Yassin Aref and Muhammad Hussein, are sitting in prison. Yassin Aref is in a special Muslim prison called the Communications Management Unit in Marion, Illinois. Muhammad Hussein is 15 years in Fairton, New Jersey. What they've left behind are two families. Between the two men, they have 10 children. The children right now currently range in age from 4 years to 16 years. Yassin Aref has only held his little baby daughter, who is the most adorable child in the world, twice in his life. His family's visited him twice in the last 2.5 years that he's been in Marion, Illinois. He does have more phone calls than the Duca brothers. He's allowed now to have 2 15-minute phone calls per week. Fatima Hussein is left with the pizza shop and rental properties and 6 children to take care of, which is an overwhelming task, and she's a lovely, wonderful woman. Yassin Aref's wife has been so distraught by what the FBI did that she doesn't really leave her home. When this happened in Albany, I could not believe that this happened in our country. I read about it in the paper, and I thought, what on earth is going on in our country that these men who did absolutely nothing wrong, that there was absolutely no evidence about these men at all, could be put in prison for 15 years. Now I realize they're lucky. It's only 15 years. What grew out of this, around the men grew up the Muslim Solidarity Committee, which is people in the community who support the families. And about a year and a half ago, we had a meeting where we invited a lot of other families in Albany, and we formed the Project Salaam. And what our goal is because we realize that we need to look at all these cases together, that there are hundreds of cases. Every time you hear someone say on the radio, on the TV, and they say, oh, we can try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in New York City because we've already successfully prosecuted 300 domestic terrorism cases. I think you can be assured that almost none of those people, that 300 cases, none of them are domestic terrorists, because they're all cases like ours. What Project Salaam has done is we have created a database which we're trying to track the various cases. But you can go to the website and look at the database. We also are working on letters. We have a letter here, our 7th letter to President Obama and Attorney General Holder. Now, the letters are very detailed letters about the actual individual cases. So the letters do describe a lot of the legal issues involved in these cases. We have had absolutely no response, no response at all from President Obama or Attorney General Holder about the letters that we started sending last February.
There's so much to talk about, so many cases, that if you start to try to deal with all the details of each of the cases, you become completely overwhelmed by it all. So my job here tonight is really to try to give you the very, very big picture. And what I knew that I wasn't going to get a chance to really give a long talk, so I wrote the whole thing out on 2 pages, and if you pick up the yellow sheet, you can see what I really wanted to say to you. But what I really wanted to get across was the idea somehow of giving this process, this thing, it's like a disease that's sweeping across the country, in which innocent Muslims are locked up for crimes that they didn't commit. And we have to give it a name. The name that I think is clear here is preemptive prosecution. What does that mean? Well, I think it starts with the Cheney 1% doctrine. You know, the idea that if there's 1% chance that the unimaginable might happen, you have to act as if it's a certainty. So, translated into this, if there's 1% chance that some Muslim might commit a terrorist act down the road, you have to take them out. You have to get them locked up. And that is the motive or the impetus that is driving all of this. It is this sense that you have to preempt a terrorist act from happening by locking somebody up if there's even a 1% chance, if there's any chance at all that they might do it. How does this 1% chance get calculated? Well, at Project Salaam, we've been studying this, we've been looking at these various cases, and there seem to be a number of different ways that this suspicion can arise in the mind of the government. One of the worst things you can do as a Muslim is to be generous, to give money to charity. Virtually all of the Muslim charities were immediately shut down. Their leaders were prosecuted. The government made good use of the material support for terrorism statute, in that if you give any support to a designated terrorist organization, then you are considered to have committed a crime. The idea that you could, for example, I think the Holy Land case is perhaps the best example of this, where they prosecuted the leaders of the Holy Land Foundation dealing with the Palestinians, and although there was no evidence, and the government conceded that the Holy Land Foundation had not helped the terrorists directly in any way, it was the very fact that by building hospitals in Palestine, they had helped to enhance the prestige of Hamas. And in that way, it helped. So the idea that you help some poor person in Palestine means that you are now helping the terrorists who happen to be in de facto control of the government at that point. I mean, this is the kind of nutty thinking that the government is going through. Another way that you can become suspicious in the eyes of the government is to be associated with terrorists, associated with somebody who's associated with a terrorist. So that in the Hashmi case, for example, some person comes by, stays for a little while, leaves a bag of clothes for a week, and then goes on his way. The clothes eventually end up with some terrorist group, and so you have assisted the terrorists by allowing the bag to stay in your apartment for a week. I mean, it's this sort of thing. Again, it's the 1%. If there's any chance that this person might have helped a terrorist in some way, then they're going to go after you and try to take you out. Of course, there are the agent provocateurs, and we've heard a lot of examples of that. And then, of course, the government is engaged deeply in warrantless electronic surveillance of all kinds. And certainly from my point of view as a lawyer, I assume every conversation I have now is being monitored. I think all of you should too. That sort of thing is now widely understood to be a problem. And then I think another thing that comes up is the problem with reports from just everyday citizen vigilantes, and I think what happened to the Fort Dix Five and the clerk picking up the home movie of these guys holding up some guns and shouting Allah Akbar and deciding that was terrorist, and that causes the FBI to send in a group of two agent provocateurs to take them out, to create conversation which they can then spin in such a way as to convince a jury that they are terrorists. It's a serious disease. I think it is, as John Dean at one point said, it's a cancer growing on the judiciary, it's a cancer growing on the Justice Department. Eventually something is going to have to be done about it. At Project Salaam, what we are sort of urging two things. If you look at the back of the other handout that we have, it is a resolution that we wanted the Albany Common Council to adopt. And part of that resolution at the very end, if you go to the end, it is asking that the Department of Justice appoint a special prosecutor to review all the cases of Muslims that were entrapped or were preemptively prosecuted, to review those cases because of all the internal memos that would have indicated that the government itself never believed that these were real crimes. I don't believe any of these prosecutors believe that these are real crimes. I think they're saying, we have been given orders from Washington to take these people out for one reason or another. We know this is fake. And I think if any honest lawyer went through those files and looked at them, they would see it was a fake and they would throw the cases out. As it happened, the Attorney Inspector General at one point went through and looked at all of the secret surveillance programs. And they discovered that the secret surveillance programs were set up in such a way that there was no ability to find exculpatory information within those programs. That is to say, they were good at catching the people in things that might look bad, but they had no way of conveying to the trial court or at trial information that shows that they were not guilty. And so the inspector general himself was saying, you need to appoint a special prosecutor to go back and review all of these cases to see whether or not, in fact, your own evidence shows that they were not guilty. So far, the Justice Department has done nothing. And we need to bring public pressure to ensure that happens, that the inspector general's own report is made the law of the land and that the Justice Department appoint a special prosecutor to review these cases. The other thing was that as we reviewed for this memo, and you'll see I took a number of quotes from the government at the press conferences, and it turned out that the press conferences were a wonderful source of information. For some reason, after the trial was over, the government loved to talk about their successes and how they preemptively prosecuted people, and it actually was very illuminating. It showed, in fact, how innocent these people really are. So if any people out there have the opportunity or the ability to get films of press conferences after the fact, I'd love to see them, and I'd like to go over them and look at for them. And so you can maybe get in touch with us and let us know if you have some. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We hear from 12-year-old Leila Duca, a member from the Fort Dix 5 case.
Hi, everyone. Some of you may or may not know me. Well, if you don't, I'm Leila Duca, and I'm 12 years old in 6th grade. As some of you know, my dream is to become a lawyer to help free all innocent people from the prisons. Since you know who I am, let's get to the Fort Dix 5 case, because this is why I came here on this very day. I'm the daughter to Ethan Duca and the niece of Shane and Elvira Duca. They were set up by two informants and are now being accused of terrorists. Supposedly, they wanted to attack the military base in Fort Dix, but guess what? They never dreamt of harming anyone, here or abroad. They never even mentioned it, ever. The only reason why they are in prison right now is because they were good in the religion, and of course, because we are Muslims. Can anyone tell me why? The 465 case is such a lie, and it's not only this case. There are many cases all over the world where people are set up for no reason at all. And if I could list them, I would go on and on about all the cases. The judge we had, you want to know what he kept mentioning over and over again? Money. He was so prejudiced, you could just see from his face. And I don't feel bad for myself because guess what? I'm the oldest of five children. Not one, but five. I mostly feel bad for my brother because he was the closest one to my father. And now he has a life in jail. And now the only way we can communicate with him is through letters. All my brothers and sisters have pain inside them, but the youngest one, which is 5 years old, she was 3 when they got arrested. She still doesn't understand, but she still thinks her father and uncles are on vacation in the Poconos. But guess what? When she gets older, she's going to understand and have more pain inside her. I'm in middle school. When I'm learning, all I think about is my father and uncles and how the FBI set them up. We have to stop this torture. The only reason why my father and uncles came to the U.S. is because this country was more free. But it's not anymore. What happened to the Pledge of Allegiance and justice for all? And I'm going to end with this. Remember, stand up for what's right. No more torture. Free the Duca brothers and all political prisoners. Takbir, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
How are you doing? My name is Burim Duca. I'm the youngest brother of the three Duca brothers, Tritan, Shane, and Elvir Duca. And the other two, Mohammed Schnuwer and Sadar Tatar, they were also close friends of me and my brothers. I'm going to give you a brief explanation of how this case started. It started with me, my brothers, Mohammed Schnuwer and Sadar Tatar, and a couple of other family members and friends. We went to the Poconos for vacation. We went to the shooting range over there, saying Allahu Akbar, which means God is great. We went snowboarding, skiing. We went horseback riding. We were just having fun over there. And when we came back to our houses, me and my brother Elvir Duca, we went to Circuit City to transform the tape into a DVD format so that we could give it to all the members that were in Poconos with the vacation for us. And then when we sent in the tape, The clerk at Circuit City, he was looking into the tape. He was actually seeing the whole video, which is illegal to do. You're not allowed to look into someone else's privacy. He called up the cops and he said there's people screaming Allahu Akbar and shooting guns. So he thought we were terrorists. And then the police called the FBI. And from then they sent an informant, Mahmoud Omar. They sent him to the Schnoor family. Mahmoud Omar, he kept on trying to push Mohammed Schnoor into downloading jihad videos. He kept on pushing him. Before Mohammed Schnoor knew the informant, he never downloaded any videos on his computer or anything. 100% of, almost 100% of the videos were downloaded from the informant requesting him to download it, so the FBI has something against him, some proof against him. And then after that, the Mahmoud Omar, the informant, he tried to push Mohammed Schnoor into talking with my brothers for a conspiracy case. A conspiracy case is when two or more defendants, not a defendant and an informant, two or more defendants have to agree to a plot to attack something or someone, which never happened in this case. Mahmoud Omar, he kept on taunting Mohammed Schnoor. He kept on trying to push him, get the Duka brothers into this, try to talk to them. But Mohammed Schnoor always used to lie to him. He used to say, no, I can't talk to them because their father was around or something. He always made up excuses to try to get away from the informant. But he kept on pushing him and pushing him. And the FBI seen that that wasn't working to get us into doing a conspiracy. So they got another informant, an Albanian informant from me and my brothers. His name was Besnik Bekali. He kept on telling my brothers, there's Muslim people dying abroad, overseas. He said, why are we sitting in Dunkin' Donuts drinking coffee when we should be doing something? My brothers used to tell him, what are you talking about? Muslims, it's haram, it's forbidden for a Muslim to do that. And my brothers kept on explaining to him about the religion, the truth about the religion. You're not supposed to be fighting or anything like that, no war. It's forbidden in our religion, and the informant still kept on trying to taunt them and taunt them. My brothers always used to like try to get them out of our way. They got arrested, my brothers. The court started, the trial and everything started. And like my niece said, during the trial, the judge, Judge Robert B. Kugler, used to say, we spend millions of dollars on this case, as if money was a reason to find them guilty. It's unbelievable what he did. And he said the lack of evidence, this is during the sentencing, when he sentenced my brother, he said the lack of evidence doesn't concern me, he said. They could have been conspiring when the recordings weren't on. Now how can you convict someone when there's no evidence against them? And the government said themselves, we don't have any proof that they were talking to each other about attacking Fort Dix. So how are you going to convict innocent men and convict them for life? Life plus 30 years. It's unbelievable. My brother, he just sent a letter saying that if we weren't Muslims, he said the maximum was 11 to 14 years in prison. But just because they're Muslim, they're facing life. And the charge that they got acquitted for was attempted murder. And that's actually doing a crime, murdering someone. He said that my brother said the maximum for that was 20 years. But just because they were Muslim, they got convicted for life. That's how you know that the government is against Muslim. They're trying to lock up as many Muslims as possible. And they're still following me. They're trying to lock me up. They came to my house and told me straight out, we want you in jail. I don't really care, though. And we barely get to see my brothers. We're not even allowed to visit yet. I'm not allowed to visit. My parents, they should be visiting soon. And my niece, we only get to talk on the phone once a month for 15 minutes. And there's 13 people in my house, so we barely get to talk to them. We only get letters, and the letters aren't allowed to be more than 7 pages, I think. The lawyers, they're not even working on the case. They were scared of the judge during the whole trial. The judge wasn't letting the lawyers bring out witnesses. They weren't letting them take out evidence that was good for my brothers. The judge would just make up an excuse saying, no, it's not good evidence. And the jury, which is illegal in our case, were all from the army. or had relatives in the army, which is illegal to have someone from the army in a case that's about attacking an army base. It's illegal for that to happen. And juror number three, because during the trial they were showing jihad videos on the screen, and juror number three, she had her son in Iraq during the war, and her son got wounded in the war, and she seen a video of an American soldier getting shot, and she threw down the evidence book because she got mad. And the judge didn't even take her out of the jury or nothing, which you're supposed to do. She's showing that she's prejudiced against Muslims. The judge didn't even do anything about that either. I just want everyone to try and help us, the Hashmi case, the Newberg case, every other case. I want everyone to try and talk to the media or write letters to Obama and so that they could look into the case. And inshallah, God willing, all the Muslim brothers and innocent prisoners will be released. Thank you.
That was Lejla Duka and her family members.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Set my poor old body.